Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Jeffrey Swartz here with my compatriot Brendan Beery, and hanging on and being there for us is Hezzy Harris. I have to give our usual disclaimer to start the show, and that is that the opinions that Brendan and I espouse are not, well, first of all, I have to tell you, we are professors of law at WMU Thomas M. Cooley Law School, the Tampa Bay campus. And so now I have to tell you that what we say and what our opinions may be are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty at large or individually. They're just our own opinions, and we live and die with them. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How was your Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was full of turkey, and, I think I'm over my turkey hangover now, so we're ready to go.
Oh,
how about you?
It was fine. You had the perfect keto Thanksgiving, right?
I did. Instead of mashed potatoes, you make mashed cauliflower, have some green beans and some turkey, and you're good to go.
There you go. And I did all the stuff that other people, you know, who aren't on keto did. Okay.
Stuffing.
Cook the turkey.
Potatoes.
Stuffing.
Right.
Mashed potatoes. Sweet potatoes with all that sugary stuff on top. You
sugary
know,
cranberry
you
sauce. Yep. Yeah,
no,
yeah.
We forgot the cranberry sauce. After the meal, I said, you know what we forgot? We forgot the cranberry sauce. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I don't eat the ones that are, you know, with the big cranberries in them whole. I eat the jelly cranberry sauce.
The
okay.
Canned
oh,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The canned one, you know, with all the sugar in it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
You know,
easy
the one
to prepare.
That
slide it out and eat it. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. You just slice it. Mm-hmm. You know, the funny part is that if you eat that stuff and then you drink a glass of water, it makes the water really bitter. I don't know why, but you got to eat something after that before you drink the water. Okay, just, you know, don't drink the water. Okay, sort of like Mexico. Don't drink the water. Okay. Okay. So, here we go. All right. Well, I'm so glad we had a good Thanksgiving. Eating all that turkey and then taking a nap, you know, unbuttoning your belt and all that kind of stuff. It's like a family tradition, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The national
and 3 days of leftovers.
Now.
Don't forget that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing better than a turkey sandwich with dressing, okay, so that you're eating double the bread. Okay. There's something really special about that. Let's kind of skip that for this moment. We start out each of our shows and we've got a lot to talk about today. We really do. We start out the show with a segment that each of us fulfills called What Do I Really Think? And Brandon's got dibs on a really good one, so I'm going to keep mine short because I really want to hear this. My thing is this, I've been watching this back and forth, between Ilhan Omar and, Boebert. I think that's her name. Boebert. Yeah. From Colorado. I want to preface this by saying I have a dog. I was in Colorado for, Thanksgiving. No one is ignored more on the news around the Denver area than Ms. Boebert. And I got the feeling from talking to my daughter and reading a few things that Ms. Boebert is not particularly popular in her district. She draws crowds of 10, 12 people. And, of course, it makes them stand real close to her. So when they take a picture, it looks like a crowded room. And she was up on a stage doing her stand-up comedy routine, telling a story that never happened, that she made up just because she thought it was funny, in which she intimated that Representative Ilhan Omar from the wonderful state of Minnesota is, in fact, a a Muslim terrorist, and that she carries around bombs in a backpack, and is referred to as the Jihad Squad. Incredibly offensive, but was funny to the 12 people that were there listening to it. I have to say there was another call, there was a telephone call that was made. By the way, it should be noted, Representative Boebert has never apologized for the comments. She says, I'm sorry if you were offended by them, which is basically, I was speaking the truth, but if you're offended by them, you're offended by the truth, I'm sorry. That's basically her attitude. There was a phone call in which Ms. Boebert called and basically doubled down on the things that she was saying in general about Muslims, and calling out Representative Ilhan Omar about certain issues that were before the Congress, called her called her anti-Semitic, said that she was a socialist, said that she was a danger to the country, and basically said your opinions on all of those are bad. And Representative Omar just basically said, I thought this was an apology call. Obviously, it's not. Goodbye, and hung up. And afterwards said, you know, I'll listen, I'll discuss anything with anybody as long as they're not bigoted and as long as they're not racist. Ms. Boebert put up a comment of her own defending her position as opposed to, you know, understanding that what she did was basically impugn the integrity of a member of Congress and called her a terrorist. I think that this type of behavior, first of all, you should know that Representative Boebert is incredibly unpopular in her district. They all realize that they made a horrible mistake putting her in Congress, that she is basically just, and I don't mean this in a sexist way, she's a little girl. She's the bad girl in high school. She's just mean. She's the mean girl in high school. And she has the intelligence level of someone who didn't actually graduate from high school. And she's done nothing for her district, literally nothing. I mean nothing. She's passed nothing. She's proposed nothing. She has done nothing but party and put herself in the news. She is a disgrace, an utter and complete disgrace. And the people of Colorado have had enough of her already, and she hasn't even made it a whole year. And she really should not have quit her day job, you know, tending bar. And she should be prepared. She should be taking what I guess it would be advanced drink mixing. You know, continuing education and drink mixing, so that she's prepared to do all the new drinks when she goes back to work. I think that it is just, you know, it's sad. And the sadder part of that is that after she issued that non-apology apology, Taylor Greene, Marjorie Taylor Greene, ye of Northwest Georgia, criticized Boebert for apologizing and said, you should never apologize to people who want to do our country harm. You should never apologize to Muslims. They're a danger to this country. I mean, just double down on what Boebert said by criticizing Boebert. These two people, and I'm not picking on them because they're women. I don't want to hear from women. I'm picking on them because they're women, because I'll throw Louis Gohmert in there, and I'll throw Paul Gosar in there, okay, so I can equal it out, okay? Let's just say all four of the 10 members of the insurrection caucus need to go. And fortunately, of all of those, three of them are in serious danger. By the way, both Marjorie Taylor Greene and Ms. Boebert have Republican challengers in their primary already. And like I said, they haven't even made it into a year of their term, and they already have a challenge from their own party. And then they have the nerve to criticize McCarthy. Well, everybody has the right to criticize McCarthy, but even probably his wife. But it really is one of those things where I've just had it with these people, and it's time to just shut them down. I don't even want to hear about them anymore. I want them to get no press. I want them to get no coverage. I want anything they say or do to be embargoed. That's simple. Just shut them off. And let's let the Republican Party take care of them. And that's what I think about that. Pretty calm for me.
Yeah, so far. We'll see.
Yeah, you got a couple of buttons you're going to push. I just know.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead.
Yep.
Okay.
But
go ahead.
Well, I'm going to add to your list. Ronnie Jackson.
Yeah.
Ronnie Jackson. For anybody who doesn't remember Ronnie Jackson, he was the president's physician, Donald Trump's attending physician when Donald Trump was president. Ronnie Jackson made his name by getting up in front of a podium, in front of the press, and declaring that Donald Trump was, had the genes to live for 200 years only weighed 230 pounds, which just coincidentally happened to be the cutoff before you call somebody obese.
That's his big toe.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's his big toe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So he really, obviously lying on behalf of Donald Trump and glorifying Donald Trump and holding him up in that way is exactly what Donald Trump, needs from people, his narcissistic supply. Ronnie Jackson, of course, was in Donald Trump's good graces, and now guess where Ronnie Jackson is? He's in Congress. It's worth repeating, and I don't know how, given what I'm about to talk about, that Ronnie Jackson is a doctor. All right.
No, he's not.
Okay. We'll just make it up as we go along.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He is. Unfortunately, he is, which raises serious questions. One associates doctors with science. For example, Dr. Fauci. But here's the latest from Ronnie Jackson. Somebody who, to repeat, holds a medical degree and has treated patients. He says now that this whole thing about the Omicron variant, right? So the new strain of COVID, which the president yesterday very calmly said, is something to be concerned about, but it's not something to panic about. We're still studying it. You're not seeing Democrats running around pushing the panic button. That's not the way the Democrats operate.
Switch your business to power over on the 5G.
And
you're afraid you can get the 5G business unlimited.
Sorry about that. That was me. I'm sorry.
Are you surfing the net instead of listening to my...
No, I'm looking for a name. I'm not surfing. I'm looking for a name. And
yeah,
I have
yeah.
it now. Nanny, nanny,
okay.
poo-poo.
Okay, I think I might know who it
now.
Is. I think I might know
yeah,
who
okay,
it is.
Yeah, okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
So here's his theory now that he's espousing publicly. Now, from a member of Congress who's also a doctor, it is that Democrats have invented this new variant, right? So it's something that they wanted to do. It's a hoax of some kind, invented by the Democrats. And the reason Democrats want to spread hysteria. Again, if anybody out there can give me an example of a Democrat getting hysterical about the Omicron variant, I'd like to see it. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it from the president. I haven't seen it from the vice president. I haven't seen it from a Democrat in Congress. I don't know where all these Democrats are who are hysterical about the Omicron variant. But according to Ronnie Jackson, the reason Democrats want to spread this hysteria about all these new variants is that they want to steal the next election, too. So he's combining the two biggest Republican lies in one mega macro lie. His theory is that if Democrats can keep this pandemic going for long enough and keep people scared enough, then state legislatures will keep allowing, mail-in voting, and opening up, other avenues to vote other than in-person voting. And that's how Democrats win elections. So he's got the two big lies, right? The lie that COVID is anything less than a deadly and highly contagious disease. The lie that it's some kind of a hoax. A lie, by the way, which is killing more right-wingers than anybody else because they're the ones who refuse to get vaccinated, refuse to get the first shot, the second shot, or the booster. There's that lie, and then there's the big lie about elections and how Democrats it is the height of irony that any time you hear a Republican accuse Democrats of something, it's usually what they're doing themselves. Right, accusing Democrats of trying to rig election results. At the same time, Republican legislatures around the country are doing exactly that, trying to restrict access to voting. So just a remarkable twist that this person was able to combine both of those into one big lie. And, you know, I got to say this. We're at the point where if you self-identify as a Republican among all of this madness and all of this dishonesty, counter to science, counter to evidence, counter to empiricism, if you still self-identify identify yourself with this party and this movement, you are intellectually compromised in a way that is shameful. No discipline in thinking. No commitment to learning. Should not be a part of our public discourse. It is so dangerous. Going back to what you said, Jeff, when you listen to the way Republicans talk about their political enemies, which they call liberals, there are different ways to frame the people you're afraid of, or let me put it this way, people you're attacking, groups of people you're going after. You can frame them as being different and odd, right? And this will provoke tribalism. And the impulse, if you successfully frame a group as being just strange, right, and the other, then the impulse within the majority is to exclude that group, right? Just simply exclude them. Well, keep them out. If the only problem with them is that they're different, that all we got to do is keep them out. You can also frame the people you're going after as inferior somehow, right? Not worthy of being in the same space. And if you succeed in that type of bigotry, I'll call it, then the natural impulse there is to oppress, right? So When you frame a group as different and strange, the impulse is to exclude. If you frame a group as inferior, the impulse is to oppress. Then there's what Republicans are doing now, and this is what is so dangerous. You can also frame the people you're going after as dangerous, as coming for your jobs, for your culture, for your guns, coming for your God, trying to indoctrinate your children, trying to kill the unborn, right, and then eating babies once they are, trying to enact a communist takeover of your country, right, all of this, of being terrorists or terrorist coddlers. These are the types of arguments that frame a group as not just strange or not inferior, but as dangerous. And when you succeed in framing a group as dangerous, right, now the only way for the majority to deal with that group is to confront that group and to eliminate it. And the kind of rhetoric that you hear coming out of every Republican Jeff talked about, plus this guy Ronnie Jackson, they are fear-based appeals. They frame Democrats and liberals as themselves a viral threat to the Republic. And it's worth pointing out that these are the people with most of the guns. and they're asking for it. Something bad is going to happen. I think you hear Democratic members of Congress saying that now over and over again. This rhetoric from these people is out of control, and something bad is going to happen. And you didn't hear it here first, but you heard it here.
No, you heard it done. A lot of people saying that. I have to say this. However, I want to tell you that going back to Ronny Jackson, there's a doctor who's on CNN all the time. He's, you know, he delves in a lot of different subject matters as a doctor, but one of the things he talked about the other day was just those statements that were made by Ronny Jackson. And he referred to him as a former doctor.
Okay.
And afterwards kept referring to him as Mr. Jackson. Would not even use the term doctor to describe Ronny Jackson. And I understand he's got the diploma. I assume he has the diploma. I mean, I don't know that. That's just to say, I assume it. Okay. And he sold his soul for a job in the White House.
Yep.
And that's fine. But don't go out there and brag that you're a doctor. It's like Rand Paul, okay? I wouldn't let this guy touch me, okay? I'd rather go blind than have Rand Paul work on my eyes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Rather go blind, because he's going to make me blind anyway, okay? But Ronny Jackson goes out there and says the things he says on the basis that he's a doctor. Well, I hate to tell you something, buddy, okay? And I happen to agree with my compatriot here. You aren't a doctor. You got a diploma. Everybody who graduates law school is a lawyer. That doesn't make them an attorney. The bar makes you an attorney. So you have the diploma, but you're no doctor. Okay? And you know, we've had a lot of doctors think that they're legislators. They think it's easy. All they got to do is fight socialized medicine. But we got, you know, we got Rand Paul out there, and I wouldn't let him touch me either. Okay? And as I've always said, where's his neighbor when we really need him? So, okay. You haven't heard much from him or from Marco. Little Marco. We haven't heard from Little Marco in a while. But we're going to talk about him in a little while. So, okay. So I happen to agree with you on Ronny Jackson. But thank you, Dr. Jonathan Reiner, for referring to him as Mr.
Yeah.
As Mr. Jackson.
Yeah.
Not Dr. Jackson, Mr. Jackson. Okay. So we'll just leave it at that. That's like being a judge and everybody refers to you as attorney. Okay. Like, man, you got the gavel, but you haven't got the gravitas. How's that?
Yeah.
So we'll
right.
just leave it at that.
Yep.
Okay.
Try
so,
that in
so
front
what
of the Supreme
gonna,
Court, right?
Yeah. What else?
Mr. Roberts.
Oh, we need. Yeah, Mr. Roberts. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then we'll have Jimmy Cagney calling him that. That's a very famous movie. You have no idea what I'm talking about, Brendan. That was the name of a movie with Henry Fonda and James Cagney called Mr. Roberts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a World War II movie, and you know, World War II, that's nothing.
You think I haven't seen World War II movies? You know.
We'll say that again?
You think I haven't seen any World War II movies?
Well, I'm sure you have. Especially the ones recent that have nothing to do with the truth. They're just dramatized. Okay.
It sounds like you might be jealous of my youth. You might be jealous of my youthfulness. That's what's going on here. Yeah.
Brendan, I am so jealous of your youth. And it's like I always say, youth is wasted on the young. Okay. And there you go. Take that one with you. Okay.
Oh, God.
Well,
speaking of Mr. Roberts, we got to talk about John Roberts. So go ahead and kick it off.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into.
We have
to talk about this, and we have to spend some time on it. Tomorrow is going to be an oral argument that everybody who has any interest at all, which is everybody, is going to want to listen to if they can. And this is the case of Mississippi versus I can't remember the name of the camera. The clinic. But it's the Mississippi abortion case, in which mm-hmm. the state of Mississippi has decided that there shall be they're going on the heartbeat basis, and they want to outlaw all abortions after there is a heartbeat that is discernible, which most people put at about 5 weeks, which by the science is not accurate. What you hear at 5 weeks is the fluttering of cells that eventually will form the heart. Not actually the heart beating. There is no heart at that point. Just a bunch of cells that will form the heart. And a discernible heartbeat is still another month to a month and a half away. But, you know, some doctors say, well, it's the heart because it's the cells that make up the heart. And so Mississippi wants to create this heartbeat basis of denying people, women in particular, obviously, a termination of their pregnancy. And it's under challenge. Coupled with this particular case from Mississippi is the still pending argument before the Supreme Court for an injunction to stop the Texas law from going into effect, which works on a 5-week basis. And we've talked about all of the things that go with that, but what's at risk here is that the Attorney General of the state of Mississippi, as it's supposedly supposed to be pronounced, Mississippi, has argued and placed in his brief that let's just do away with Roe v. Wade altogether and let the states determine whether they will permit abortions, I like to call them terminations of pregnancies, at all, zero, at all. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Mississippi law flies in the face of Roe v. Wade, which designated the first trimester as being a period in which that women should have the absolute right to terminate a pregnancy. So that's what's before the court. And the fact that the Texas case has not been decided somewhat answers the question, because the Texas case is based upon, that's before them for an injunction, is based upon the idea that they should not allow that law to go forward as long as Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. And so, therefore, it's an easy call if Roe is going to survive. It's a harder call or a no call if Roe is not going to survive. Mm-hmm. And so tomorrow's a kind of an important day, and you're going to see, I believe, some very sharp questioning. I think you may see argument on the bench between members of the court. It has happened before. I think it's going to happen tomorrow. I think there's no way Sotomayor is going to be able to hold herself back. She has great temperament, but I cannot see her holding herself back. And you may see actually Clarence Thomas get into an argument with a fellow member of the court during oral argument. I'm predicting that may happen. It's going to be that contentious. And it's going to be more tension-filled than watching the results from a presidential election for 24 hours. And I don't know what's going to happen. I think everybody knows where Roberts is. Right now it's 5-4. The question is, will one of the five members of the Curia okay? Okay? Be willing to say no to overruling Roe v. Wade. And the only hope, in my opinion, is Brett Kavanaugh. And it's not that Brett Kavanaugh doesn't want to say no to Roe v. Wade. I think Brett Kavanaugh made a promise. He verbalized a promise to Susan Collins during his confirmation proceedings that he would not overturn Roe v. Wade, that it was a super precedent and it cannot be, it should not be overturned. And if he's true to his word, then he has to vote against overturning Roe v. Wade. If he's the political hack that all of us know he is, who will lie through his teeth to get what he wants, then he'll go with the majority. That's what I think is going to happen. There's no question Clarence Thomas has wanted to get rid of Roe v. Wade since the day he got on the bench. This is a man who hates women to begin with. I see Gorsuch not bound by anything, although he believes in precedent, although he believes in super precedent. I think that his Catholic background overtakes him. We know Alito's going to vote that way, and we know where, you know, Sister Amy Coney Barrett will stand. So it really, to me, comes down to Kavanaugh. Or you might see decisions that are what we call plurality decisions, agreeing in the judgment but not in the reasoning, which means that the opinion would hold absolutely no precedent at all. That could happen. And maybe very likely. So we'll see.
Yeah, this
so
is
maybe. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are two. You know, I think there are two. As you say, Mississippi is arguing for outright overruling Roe versus Wade. So I think there are two separate tracks for the court to go on here. Because Roe versus Wade, you know, it's still good law. The trimester framework has been thrown out. And so courts talk about Roe versus Wade in terms of what they call the central holding. And the central holding of Roe versus Wade is that a woman has a right to terminate a pregnancy early in the pregnancy, pre-viability. And that idea has been upheld consistently, that the dividing line between when a state has to permit abortions, it can impose certain medical restrictions, you know, that are reasonable, but it has to permit abortions, and the time when they can ban abortions, as long as they have appropriate exceptions for the health of the mother, that dividing line is the point of viability, which right now is understood to be around 24 weeks. So both, you know, when you look at these state laws that are being enacted, whether it's 15 weeks or 6 weeks, whichever way you slice it, we're well short, right, of the point of fetal viability, which is the point at which the fetus can survive outside the womb without extraordinary medical intervention. So when I talk about the two tracks, right, there's the first question is, what is the court going to do with the central holding of Roe? Are they going to overrule it outright and say, no, a woman has no constitutionally protected right to terminate a pregnancy, period? Or are they taking all this time and going through all these machinations, trying to figure out a way to get rid of, right, a woman's right to have an abortion without saying that they're getting rid of it? You're right. There are some justices who want to say it. And I would agree there are probably at least four who want to say it. Look, we're getting rid of Roe. It wasn't correctly decided. There's no textual basis for it, and we're getting rid of it. That you've probably got four justices who are angling to say that. But Kavanaugh and Roberts, I think it's pretty clear. We know that Roberts is not for overruling Roe. He's an institutionalist. He doesn't want to do that. doesn't want us, the court to be seen as swinging wildly ideologically just because there's a new composition of the court. So we know where he is. He doesn't want to overrule Roe. I'm sure he's on board, however, with tinkering with it, right? And so the question is really Kavanaugh. Does he want to go with four justices and say, forget it, we're getting rid of Roe versus Wade and break a promise that he made to Susan Collins? And not only did he make that promise to Susan Collins, but she made it clear, right? You and I talked earlier in a floor speech that he had made that promise.
That's correct.
Or does he gang up with Roberts and say, okay, we're going to let the other four say they want to overrule it. The two of us will say we're not overruling it. But, you know, fetal heartbeat or some other benchmark is now an appropriate marker, right, for when a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy ends, which would effectively get rid of a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy because, as many medical people and as you just discussed, women, you know, if you're talking about 6 weeks, many women don't know at 6 weeks that they're pregnant. So for all intents and purposes, if states can ban abortions after 6 weeks, women don't have access to abortion anymore as a practical matter. And we talked, too, about, you know, one other point I wanted to make. We talk about this abortion issue. And this is very difficult to get people on the other side of this to understand. I have never met anybody who is, quote, unquote, pro-abortion. I have never had a conversation with anybody who thought that abortion is a good thing, that it is a something that's beneficial to in any way. I think there's rather universal concern that abortions are not is not a happy thing. Okay, it's not a positive outcome. The issue isn't, are you for abortion or against it? The issue is, as I repeatedly put it, the issue is one of jurisdiction. Okay, it's not a question of whether I personally am for, think a woman should have an abortion or think a woman shouldn't, whether that's based on my religious beliefs or any other set of values. That's not the issue. The issue is whether I or the government or the body politic has jurisdiction over a woman's decision whether to terminate a pregnancy or whether the woman has jurisdiction over that decision. People who say there's no textual basis for the right to abortion are skipping over parts of the Constitution. The Ninth Amendment says that there is such a thing as unenumerated rights, that we retain rights that are not listed in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The Tenth Amendment says, and is frequently misread and misquoted, says that the power not given to the federal government in the Constitution is reserved to the states, comma, or to the people. So there is a sphere of power and jurisdiction over life that is reserved to individual people. So there is that's what we're talking about. Okay, is this decision whether to terminate a pregnancy, does that belong to the federal government? Do they have jurisdiction over it? Does the state have jurisdiction over it? Or does the woman have jurisdiction over it?
You know, in that regard.
But let me, if you don't mind, just allow me to intrude for a moment. Somebody's been on hold now for about 9 minutes. Let's see if we can take them in. I didn't want to interrupt you. So just let's pull them in and see what they want to say. Oh, I have a question. Bear with me a moment. We'll get that caller. Okay. Good morning, caller. Thanks for calling. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I got a comment and a question.
Okay.
The powers not giving to the federal government is reserved to us. That means the states give the power. Give the Congress, the federal government, powers. But people don't seemingly know that and don't practice that, don't look at it like that. It's the other way around. I'm for the states controlling this particular issue myself. Mm. And also for Kavanaugh to have an agreement like that is really superficial. Suppose things change. At the moment, he say, I agree to this, but the time when the decision time comes, things may change. New information comes through and everything. Things change. Your questions on those.
Let me answer those, the first one. What you're arguing will set up for this country. Okay, and first of all, you're ignoring the 14th Amendment, and you're ignoring due process, and you're ignoring equal protection, but forgetting all of that, okay, because the superficial look at the Constitution that you give is grasping onto one thing and not looking at the entire document. But forgetting all of that, what you're asking for by saying you want the states to control this is legislative civil war in a way that we have not seen since the 1850s. Because there will be states that will outlaw abortion, and there will be states that will permit it. The problem is that it's already been tried by one state in this country, of course, shot down almost immediately a few years ago, in which they tried to pass a law saying abortion in this state is murder. And if a person who lives in this state goes to another state to have an abortion and comes back, or even if they don't come back, that person can be charged with murder because the act of the murder started when they traveled out of the state. It went even further that a doctor in another state who performs an abortion on a citizen of that particular state can be extradited and charged with murder in that state. Now, you say that can't happen. But it can. It's called the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the United States Constitution. And not only can it happen for that reason, but if you studied it in school, as I did when I was in school, there was a thing called the Dred Scott decision, in which case Mississippi considered black people to be property. And Dred Scott escaped from Mississippi and ended up in Missouri. And the people chasing him from Mississippi found him there, and they sued to get him back and said, he's our property. You have to honor our law. And the United States Supreme Court said, you're right. He is your property, and you have the right to claim him in another state. So don't say what I'm saying can't happen, because it can, and it's going to happen. And it's going to be divisive to this country. Let me finish. Because you had two points, and I'm going to finish the second point, okay? Your second point very simply was that we're ignoring the Constitution and its powers. No, the states didn't give powers to this federal government. The federal government has powers given to it. And the 10th Amendment says anything not reserved to the federal government is now reserved to the rights of the state. That was an accession to a central government. And the truth of the matter is that what we have done, and if we follow what you say, then there would be no Fourth and Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights in many of the states of this union. You wouldn't have a right to demand a warrant. You wouldn't have a right to remain silent. You wouldn't have the right to a lawyer if it wasn't for the 14th Amendment, which says that the states can't do anything to abridge the rights in the United States Constitution. So you can't look at a simple phrase in the Constitution and say that's the be-all and end-all. It is a document which requires everything in it to coordinate together. And what you're talking about is far more simplistic than the Constitution actually operates.
Well, I think that people make it more complicated than what it is. I'm African-American. I think the initial Dred Scott case was accurate ruling because his domicile was back in Africa. That's why they came up with the 14th Amendment to change things. Also, the 14th Amendment could not be grandfathered in, so it had to apply to people that was born from that point on. And as far as the states, I still think that the states have the power to control the federal government. All the Congress people come from the states. Your senators come from the states. Let it be left up to the states.
Okay. And your premise on the Dred Scott decision is inaccurate because it was not a matter of him being domiciled in Africa. It was about the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution and the command that the state of Missouri return Dred Scott to the people in Mississippi because he was property.
And that was, at that point in time, that was he was property. I mean, that's the way it was looked at. But do you think I can't take my position today and go back?
Do you want to live in a country like that?
Well, you asked me that three times. Why did you make it so complicated? I left Missouri and went to the South. Well, you know, I'm African American. I'm black. Shouldn't I have an opinion on this?
Sure you
think about it.
Okay, but
I'm a black person. Wait a minute, listen. I'm a black person, and I'm saying, because it applied to me, that at that time the ruling was an accurate ruling. You're white, and you're saying that I'm crazy.
No,
that's the problem that we have today.
Don't paraphrase me. Did I say you were crazy?
Well, it's what
I'm alluding. No.
It's alluding to
that. Did I say you were crazy? Did I say you were crazy?
You're alluding to that.
No, I didn't.
Now, this is what
all.
I'm going to say. I'm going to say it one more time.
Okay.
I agree with the premise of the first ruling that Justice Taney put down. Congress didn't. That's why come they changed it and enacted the 14th Amendment. Nothing wrong with that.
That's not accurate, but that's okay. That's not why the 14th Amendment came almost 20 years later.
That's what I see. And here's the point, too. When it did not apply to those that was born. It could only apply to those that came afterwards. Think about it. Let the state handle that because it's just
that's
too much.
It's too ridiculous the way it is now. That's not accurate either. The 14th Amendment only applied to people who were born afterwards. That's not accurate either. You vote for it to apply
with the federal government. I vote for it to apply with the states. Therefore, both of our votes are null and void. Thank you very much.
I just want to jump in and.
Go ahead.
Maybe
some of it is simpler than it was just made to sound. I mean, actually. First of all, the Constitution does not give states power over the federal government. The Constitution,
I think I
when
said
you read
that.
The history of it, yeah, but it was.
I think I said that.
I mean,
I think I said
the,
that.
The whole,
you did.
Yeah, but well, I want to okay. add to it. The Constitution was drafted largely to take power away from states and give it to a national government because we were operating under the Articles of Confederation, which was a mess.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically like a little European Union, right? Loosely affiliated countries is how things were operating. States were entering into their own treaties with foreign countries. Mm-hmm. States had their own navies. States were coining their own money.
States.
Yeah,
they considered themselves
nations. Right?
They really
yeah.
did believe that they were nations.
Yeah. And so this is and very troubling to the founders. States were placing tariffs on one another's goods and getting into trade wars and all that things that all those things that countries do. So,
right.
The Constitution says states are not allowed to have navies. They're not allowed to coin their own money. They're not allowed to enter into treaties with foreign countries. It is Congress who gets to regulate interstate commerce. So there's no more trade wars allowed. I just wanted to point that out. The entire purpose of the Constitution was to take power away from states, give that power to the federal government,
and centralize it.
And one more thing, right? Caller said you vote for the federal government to have control over it, and I vote for states to have control over it. I guess meaning a woman's decision whether to terminate a pregnancy.
Right.
That's not at all, but what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing is this, and I'm going to emphasize this. When people read the 10th Amendment, they tend to read it this way. Any power not given to the federal government is reserved to the states. And then they think there's a period after the word states. There is not a period. There is a comma after the word states. The next word is or. which is disjunctive. It means not both.
Right.
Or to the people. Okay, so there are three spheres of jurisdiction recognized. People call it dual sovereignty. It's not dual sovereignty. It's tri-sovereignty. There's three levels of sovereignty recognized in the 10th Amendment. National government, state government, and people. And we've talked about John Locke, right? This is all about reserving certain decisions over life, right, to individuals. So I just want to clarify. I don't think you and I are saying that the federal government has control or the state government has control. What I would argue is that the people, right, that this is one of those things,
right,
one of those personal decisions that is reserved to individuals in their own lives.
I would have to say, and I want to carry it one more step, that it just is pretty simple, that like so many others, okay, the caller was no different than so many other people that you talk to about the Constitution in the context that they see one phrase that they like, and all of a sudden that becomes the controlling phrase for the entire Constitution. And as I tried to explain to the caller, that if you look at it in his simplistic point of view, there would be the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments would not be applicable to the states. And they would all have their own criminal procedure and their own rules about search and seizure and about right to counsel and the right to remain silent and double jeopardy and all of those kinds of things. The 14th Amendment doesn't apply to people who were born after the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment applied at that point to everyone.
Everybody born or naturalized in the United States, right.
And even people who aren't, we use the 14th Amendment to apply the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendments and other things to people who are not citizens of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You have the right to due process the minute you walk into the United States, whether you're a citizen or not. And the 14th Amendment says you can't deny those people those rights.
Right.
The state shall take no action.
Right.
So it
I guess,
isn't
let me,
applicable
let me,
to just citizens.
Yeah,
it,
let me
it,
bifurcate
it's just wrong.
This. Let me bifurcate this. The first sentence of the 14th Amendment defines citizenship and does, in fact, overrule Dred versus Scott, which held that a man who was born in the United States was not a citizen of a state or of the United States. The first sentence says that anybody born or naturalized in the United States is a citizen of the state and of the United States, right? So the 14th Amendment goes on, as you say, to protect any person within the jurisdiction of a state. So that's correct. You don't have to be a citizen to be protected by the 14th Amendment, but the 14th Amendment clarifies that Dred Scott, contrary to what the caller said, Dred Scott was a citizen of the United States, because it doesn't matter whether he was born in the United States before or after the 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment says if you were born in the United States, and he was, then you're a citizen of the United States and the state wherein you reside. So I don't know where you get the notion that the 14th Amendment only applies prospectively to people who were born after the 14th Amendment.
I don't know where that came from.
No, that's a weird.
I don't know where that came from either, but it's an incorrect reading of the Constitution. You can't just read one phrase and say that's it. You have to read the entire document, because there is so much interplay between the things in that document, and we've talked about this before. So I the only thing that I can say is that the idea of doing away with Roe v. Wade and claiming that this is a matter for the states will drive us into a state of legislative civil war that will just destroy this country, absolutely destroy this country. And what will really happen is that we will have a group of people who have promoted ending Roe v. Wade walking around this country bragging to its congregations that, look what I did, give me more money and I can do more. This is a Christian country, they will brag. We are bringing back Christian values. That's what we're talking about. This is their jihad. This is what they're doing. And it's all about them and their wealth and their power. They have seized on something that for years now that they believe will make them even more wealthy than they already are and convert this into a theocracy. If you're not Christian, you don't belong here. That's just got that. That's what's going to happen. And it will be horrendous to watch.
Bear with me one more second. There's another call. I'm not sure if it's the next guest or if it's a call for you guys. Good morning, caller.
Next guest.
Okay, thank you. So
nice talking
you
to you. Nice talking to you.
Well, I do want to say to the caller who called in, we appreciate it.
We appreciate your call.
It's good to hear from callers, yeah.
Yeah, but when we ask questions back, you have to answer them, okay? If you say something and we answer it and we ask you a question back, we expect, you know, you have an obligation to answer. That's how we have conversations. Repeating the same thing over and over again is not an answer to the question. So we appreciate calls, and we'd love to have them, but you have to be willing to accept that there are things, just like we have to accept at times there are things we don't know, you have to learn to accept there are things that you may not know. And I think that's fair.
Well, without diminishing the caller, because that's not the intent, but it was
right.
Evident that he was not familiar with the complexity of the Constitution, which unfortunately is a reality in America. We don't really
understand. And we've talked about
law.
That. And we've talked about the reasons for that. We have.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not complimentary to the people that we say it about, but the fact of the matter is that it really is a matter that the education that people receive in the Constitution in this country right now, one of the most important things for them to learn, they're not learning.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that the caller was African-American and voicing an opinion I'm not sure that very many African-Americans happen to agree with. But the fact of the matter is he's entitled to his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to that extent, we have to remember that there are other opinions out there, and we get reminded of it sometimes in a rather direct way.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to accept that too. So that's where it kind of lay on that one. We've run out of time.
Okay, you've already got your next guest on the line, so.
yeah, no problem.
Yeah, he's waiting
Jeff,
with bated breath.
Yeah.
Definitely, Jeff, before you go, is it next week or in 2 weeks that you won't be available?
No, 2 weeks from today.
Okay.
I'm not sure that I will be on because I have to have a medical procedure that would prevent me from
right.
doing that.
Right.
But I will try. I might be able to be available, depending on how I feel. It's the morning after the procedure, so I'm not sure exactly where I'll be. But we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. That's all. Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. As always, a pleasure.
Thank you, Hezzy.
Have a
we'll
wonderful
see you next
day.
Week. Yep.
See you next
be
week.
Well.
Bye-bye.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, let's disconnect them from the line. And, there we are. So, good morning, Mr. Keston. How are you? Thank you for your patience on the line.
Pleasure. I am well. I hope you are as well.
Thank you. Thanks for asking. Well, I'm very excited. You're engaged in something that I had not heard of before. And tell us about what you're going to be doing, because you're going to be scheduling a Zoom meeting today at 7 o'clock at night. And tell us what it's about.
What it is about is exploring the possibilities of a Westchester County Human Rights County, which would be the first of its kind in the nation. In other parts of the world, there are human rights cities, but nowhere At this point, is there a county organized on those principles? And so this is a conversation with a handful of people representing different organizations and businesses, and we will see where we go. This is the fourth of a series of conversations with very small groups of people with an exploration. A human rights city is, or a human rights county in this case, is unique because it pulls together the organizations and institutions that the public has already self-selected to their needs and problems. So it could be the Y, it could be a hospital, it could be a woman's organization or an environmental group, it could be a Friends of organization. But these are organizations where people go to get benefits or contribute, meaning that they're self-selected by the people themselves to represent their needs and their wants. So in some ways, it's a more representative style of involvement than government is.
Mm-hmm. So the layer of complexity is that this would infuse an aspect that is now deficient in government?
What it does is helps government find where it's lacking and find where it's successful. It helps government address the needs of the people that it is supposed to serve. And most importantly, it reminds every citizen, every resident, every child of their inalienable human rights as determined by international law, so that they can then hold government responsible for protecting and defending those rights rather than sacrificing them for a false sense of security.
But then it also wouldn't supersede like the United States Constitution, would it?
No, but if you recall, the Constitution was a document that came after the Declaration of Independence, which already states that government has a responsibility and a duty to protect our inalienable human rights.
Correct. And what initiated this interest to form this group? What's missing in our society that needs to be delved into?
Well,
I'm sure there's a ton of stuff. I'm not trying to be stupid.
So let's take one step back, and that is that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted by the United Nations on December 10th, 1948, was a response from world governments to the ravages of World War II and the devastation of the Holocaust. So it is a document, the first of its kind, to include women as equal with men, even though we know in 1948 that was definitely not the case. But it was a document that determined that by promoting and harnessing human dignity, we had the possibility to live in a complex world, even with people we vehemently disagree with, if we could find a common language. And that common language and that common bond is found in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There is no question that whether you're in Westchester or in Palm Beach, you're finding that you are living in a very divided world. There are protests at school board meetings. There are protests at supermarkets. There are protests at hospitals. Protesting is fine, but the yelling and the screaming and the name-calling and the attacks and the threats, that is not how people live in a civil society. And finding a common ground, finding a place where we can communicate and talk to each other and not at each other would make a huge difference in our quality of life and the quality of the world around us.
So what do we infuse into society? I guess a lot of it falls into respect, doesn't it?
Well, a lot of it does.
Why are we not respectful?
Well, I think that, once again, if you look at there are 30 articles that make up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most people don't even know that there is a Declaration of Human Rights, nor do they know that their country is a signatory to that declaration.
Mm-hmm.
If after 73 years people do not know that there is a Universal Declaration of Human Rights or what's in it, it must be one of the world's best-kept secrets. And we have to ask the question, why is it a secret? Why isn't it taught every day, every week, every year in our schools so young people grow up knowing what their inalienable rights are? Inalienable means, as it says in our Declaration of Independence, that mm-hmm. they are not given by man, they are not given by government, and they cannot be taken by government. These are either natural rights, depending on what your beliefs are, or God-given rights, depending on what your beliefs mm-hmm. are. And if we don't know them, if we don't claim them, we don't have them. So living in dignity means that you have to claim your rights. It means that you have to know mm-hmm. your rights. It means that you have to hold those in power accountable for protecting and defending them. And that's what this is really about, is making sure that the 1 million people in Westchester County know what their human rights are, know how to act on them, and know how to hold their government and their communities responsible for protecting them.
So may I ask you, like, what initiated this desire to not only become aware, but also for it to conceivably be taught, because we're not going to be aware if we're not made familiar with the fact that this document
absolutely.
Is there.
Absolutely. And
so
what
brought this out?
Conversations, basically conversations. And in those conversations, people said, well, how do we get this? And one of the organizations that I've been working with for quite a long time was responsible mm-hmm. for the United Nations Decade on Human Rights Education. And out of that decade, which went from 1995 to 2004, we determined that a lack of knowledge about this subject was one of the reasons that the world was deteriorating at a relatively rapid pace in terms of civility.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing this, human rights cities were established in various parts of the world. Learning sessions were held in various parts of the world. The United States was more resistant, believing that it was ahead of the rest of the world in these arenas, which it is not, but until the pandemic, many Americans thought so. And so with the pandemic and with the experiences that people are having on social media and elsewhere, people started asking for it, and that's how it came to be.
So you mean this is one of the benefits of COVID-19? Sounds it. At least it was an instigator.
It was definitely a culprit.
Uh-huh. Okay, great word. Excellent. Great definition. And when you look at other places where there's been an interest to resuscitate what's already been written and accepted by so many places, who's at the cutting edge of being aware, or are there none?
You can't find one place in the world where all 30 articles are realized. I would say that we are all deficient in one way or another. And it is incumbent mm-hmm. upon each one of us to get a copy of the Declaration and read it and then master it. And it is a process of lifelong learning, because words mean one thing to a young person, something else to a middle-aged person, and something vastly different to an old person. And when
That's
I say
like me.
That it helps provide a language, even a word as simple as safety. Now, when you're a young child, your parent may tell you, don't put your hand on the stove because it's hot and you'll get burned. This is a safety precaution. So as a young child, you learn that safety means don't touch hot things. But if you're a black woman with teenage boys, safety means something completely different. And if you're a police officer, the word safety means, once again, something completely different. And if a word as simple as safety that we hear and use from the time we are a tot is different for everybody who uses that word, we are talking at each other and not to each other until we have common definitions and common usage of those words. Because when we use them in our current state, we're saying different things to different people.
This sounds like a gargantuan task because so many people are deficient in the language that they use to such an extent that it's almost illiterate. And you have, a lack of good verbal expression. Language is so poor, we're not told how to speak anymore. They don't have the vocabulary either, quite often. It's very frightening. It looks like in my lifetime, I feel that we've regressed tremendously.
And in some ways,
the document was written.
And in some ways we have, but in other ways, think of the immense progress that has been made. There's greater literacy on the planet than at any other time, even if it's not comprehensive. Healthcare, there's so many things that have moved forward. Technology, since the document was written, people have walked on the moon. So in certain areas, we go backwards. In other areas, we move forward. But you said it was a gargantuan task. Well, getting someone to the moon was a gargantuan task. Inventing penicillin and getting it distributed, or polio vaccine and getting it distributed to where the disease is almost gone, or smallpox where the disease is gone, those were gargantuan tasks in their day as well. So I don't think that we need to worry about the size of the problem. We have to figure out what are the solutions to the problem and how do we get to the core reasons that this is a problem. And how do we get to that core and address it there so that it doesn't keep festering and that we end up having the same conversations decade after decade, generation after generation, of why we can't get along?
So when you gather these people tonight on a Zoom call, are they all of a particular socioeconomic plane? Are they of different ethnicities or different religious backgrounds? Are you incorporating it all? Can one find every aspect for to be represented in such a discussion?
Everybody,
this has got to be huge.
Everyone.
That's wonderful.
At some point, it would have to be huge. In the beginning stages, it's small. Anybody and everybody is welcome to participate. There are no ground rules for participation other than having respect for everyone else the way you would like to be respected yourself. But otherwise, no matter what your viewpoint is, there's no reason in the world in a human rights democracy that you would be excluded. So... who will be on the call? I would imagine that it will represent different economic, social, racial, religious backgrounds. They have so far, they've been universally diverse in the three previous conversations. My belief is that this one will be too. And like I said, anyone is welcome, providing they respect others and keep a sense of dignity for themselves.
And how did you reach out to people so that they would become aware of this?
We reached out to various organizations and asked them to let their constituents know. I've spent a lot of time just sending emails to people so that they would know that this is going on. So in essence, I know that we've reached maybe 10,000 people. So 10,000 people in a county of a million people is still small, but it certainly potentially reaches a cross-section of the population.
And what was so exciting about Westchester County that, you know, became a central point to bring this forward?
Well, for one thing, the divisions in small local communities where people used historically got along was important to address. The other is its proximity to New York City and mega media. If it's successful in Westchester, many of the media people in New York live in Westchester and would become aware of its successes and its progress. And so that's why Westchester is important. It's also, being that it's a million people all told, or almost a million people all told, it's still a manageable size in order to affect change.
Can a Zoom meeting handle 10,000 people? How do you manage it?
Not the way it is right now, and we certainly only expect a handful tonight. We had two or three handfuls in the last meeting, and the biggest meeting we had, I think, had around 60 or 70 people. So
nice.
People are saying that they're interested. People are committing organizations to participate, and it will be one person at a time, one group at a time, but hopefully in time we will get there.
Well, this wouldn't be an extemporaneous type of expression, I guess, for a gathering of even 60 or 100 people. You know, people need to prepare for this, I would think. Something very
well. People don't have
and,
to.
No.
People don't have to. People don't have to prepare for these meetings, but once it is. But once the organizations within the county decide that they want to go forward with a human rights county, then the organizations themselves that represent the greatest number of people by self-selection would form an assembly, and they would be a place where people can go and voice their concerns. They would be a place to go where local budgets and county budgets would be looked at to see where that money is being spent and how, and informing the people as to where their needs are being met, where their needs are not being met, and how they can get involved in order to change that process so that they are best served.
So this isn't a government-approved project, because maybe Westchester County would shy away from some of the suggestions that could be made.
And so they very well might.
They might, but they don't have to. But then, so is Westchester County welcoming of this, or is this an initiative that has sprouted from, people interest of all
this
kinds of disciplines?
Right. No, this is definitely from the people, for the people, and it will be by the people. And
nice.
Government officials are not usually asked to participate until it gets to the stage of exploring budgetary issues. So it's a way off before elected officials, capacity as citizens, would be invited to participate in their official capacity.
Okay. So is this Zoom call, is this going to be a call to everyone in the county, or is this a selective until you move a little bit further in the process?
Anybody who wants to participate can participate. We don't give out the Zoom information because of people who bomb Zooms. But
I was very respectful. I didn't print any of that out, of course.
Thank you. But anybody who wants to attend can contact us by email, and we will send, once we have their name and their information, we're happy to send them the Zoom contact, and they can join us even this evening.
So how is that done? Do you give that out? Is there a way for them to reach out to you to ask for being included?
If they want to email and ask to participate, they just have to include their name and their email address, and we will send them the Zoom contact. So they would email.
Where do you send it to?
rtk.pdhre@igc.org.
Okay. All right. Would you mind repeating that again?
Not at all. rtk.pdhre@igc.org.
Okay. So then when they send you this email request, they have to give their name and contact information, I guess. What else did you require?
That's what we require. That's about it. We're not keeping records on people. We're not worried about where they come from or what. Ideally, they live in Westchester County or they live someplace nearby that's interested in doing the same in their community.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be nice, too. That's very, very nice. And what was the instigator for you? What moved you to, I guess, to embolden this prospect of learning and teaching?
It was my idea to go to the UN and propose the UN Decade of Human Rights Education. And my mentor and friend and the person I worked with for many years is the one who traveled around the world and got governments to commit so that when it came before the General Assembly of the United Nations, it was approved unanimously. And she was awarded the UN Human Rights Prize for that effort.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. That's amazing. And so that's humongous. Just one individual that pushed it forward and then got a lot of people to support it. That's great.
Yes.
So one person does matter, huh?
One person can make the difference in life and death and good and bad.
Yeah. That's so true. Oh my goodness! And how did you become aware of this project, or did you know this woman?
She and I worked together. It was interesting. I was working with her husband on an international agricultural project, and he asked if I would spend time with his wife, and I did. And she said she wanted to do work in human rights, and I proposed the UN Decade concept, and she said, okay. And I came up with the name UDHRE, which was UN Decade of Human Rights Education, or DHORE, which was DOR, for Decade of Human Rights Education. And she added a P, which made it People's Decade of Human Rights Education.
Nice.
And came the executive of the organization back in 2009, but was involved since, from its inception in the 90s.
Wow. Boy, that's one trip that you've been taking. Amazing, amazing. But it's got to be very, mesmerizing for you and just a challenge in every way. I guess the teaching process is probably the most difficult, isn't it?
Well, we don't even consider it teaching because lifelong learning is different than teaching a subject. So
yes.
It's really how you make it yours, how you understand it as particular to you as an individual. And amazing.
That's very complex.
Well, it's not so complex.
And simple.
When you're forced to memorize a poem in elementary school. And I remember in elementary school, I had to learn Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood by Robert Frost. And I know that I can be out walking, and that poem will just pop into my head. And I can say now that when I say those words to myself, they mean vastly different things than when I had to learn them in sixth grade or seventh grade.
Right, right.
Two roads diverging in a yellow wood meant very little to me as a seventh grader, but they mean a great deal to me now as someone who's spent a lot of time on the planet. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights fits very much in that mold. When you read those 30 articles, some of them amazingly simple, there is a huge difference in how you understand them as you get older. So reading it on a regular basis is very important because it informs how you are in the world and who you are in the world.
At a particular time.
Right. So it's a lifelong experience, and one that the more you share it with others, the better it is for you and the better it is for them.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me, or it's reminiscent to me, of like scripture. You know, it means one thing when you're a child and another thing as you grow
Absolutely.
Up and another thing. So the wisdom is there. It's just our capacity to comprehend.
Exactly. And in fact, when I would go to Egypt or Tunisia or Jordan and talk about this, I would relate it to scripture in just the way that you did, that young children in certain religions have to memorize prayers. And when they're memorizing those prayers as little children, the words mean absolutely nothing.
Right.
But as you get older, those words begin to take on meaning. And that's exactly what this is about. It's about how do you make it part of your DNA.
Yeah, that's, in a sense, you're emulating that concept, or it's just aligned to it. There's this integrity to the process.
Right.
They're analogous. Yeah, very analogous. Better word. That's really fantastic. I'm very proud of your accomplishment because I knew you from before that, or we never spoke about that, but you were always quite brilliant as far as I was concerned.
Thank you.
And there was depth in what you used to always talk about. That's really fantastic. Well, I wish you the best. It sounds perfect to me. Doesn't get better than that, that's for sure. Any last words? Anything you want to say?
Anyone who wants to reach out, please get that email, rtk.phre@igc.org, and we'll see you at 7 o'clock, and looking forward to it.
Well, thanks for making the time for us. Much success tonight and every night that you hold such a meeting. Be well. Thank you, Mr. Keston.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye. Well, there we have it, Robert Keston, the Zoom meeting that he'll be holding tonight. So I hope those that were interested wrote down the email and go on from there. Okay, so let me take a quick break for a moment, take a quick commercial, and then we'll be right back. Let's see if I could initiate this.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championship?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot cheddar.
Check.
Come back. One second. Oh, well, I wanted to go into some international issues with you. One thing, and I was listening, I don't know how I even arrived at the website, but I was listening to what was going on in Barbados. Barbados has become a republic, and in the process of becoming a republic, an independent republic, they're renouncing Britain's Queen Elizabeth. It was a brilliant and beautiful declaration. Well, Barbados ditched Britain's Queen Elizabeth as head of state, forging a new republic yesterday. It was actually, I saw the festivities yesterday, but I guess the republic has its first ever president, and it severed its last remaining colonial bonds nearly 400 years after the first English ships arrived at the Caribbean island. So at the strike of midnight, the new republic was born. That's why it's regarded as today. Shortly after Queen Elizabeth's royal standard was lowered over a crowded Heroes Square in Bridgetown. Well, Prince Charles, heir to the British throne, was on hand to witness the transition, which Republicans hope will spur discussion of similar proposals in former British colonies that have Queen Elizabeth as their sovereign. Barbados cast the removal of Elizabeth II, who is still queen of 15 other realms, including the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and Jamaica, as a way to finally break with the demons of its colonial history. After a dazzling display of Barbadian dance and music, complete with speeches celebrating the end of colonialism, Sandra Mason, she's a dame, Dame Sandra Mason was sworn in as Barbados's first president in the shadow of Barbados's parliament. Quote, full stop, this colonial page, end quote. Winston Farrell, our Barbadian poet, told the ceremony, quote, some have grown up stupid under the Union Jack, lost in the castle of their skin, end quote. It is about us rising out of the cane fields, reclaiming our history, he said. And all that she mean, put a Bajan there instead. So the birth of the Republic, 55 years to the day since Barbados declared independence, unclasps almost all the colonial bonds that have kept the tiny island tied to England since an English ship claimed it for King James in 1625. It may also be a harbinger of a broader attempt by other former colonies to cut ties with the British monarchy as it braces for the end of Elizabeth's nearly 70-year reign and the future accession of Charles. Well, Prime Minister Mia Mottley, the leader of Barbados's Republican movement, helped lead the ceremony. Mottley has won global attention by denouncing the effects of climate change on small Caribbean nations. Tonight's the Night read the front page headline of Barbados's Daily Nation newspaper. Quote, I'm overjoyed, Ras Bin Ghi, I hope that's pronounced correctly, a Bridgetown cobbler, told Reuters ahead of the ceremony. Bin Ghi said he would be saluting the new republic with a drink and a smoke. Prince Charles, whose arrival was cheered by hundreds of people lining the Chamberlain Bridge and the wharf in Bridgetown, will give a speech highlighting the continuing friendship of the two nations despite England's central role in the transatlantic slave trade. While Britain casts slavery as a sin of the past, some Barbadians are calling for a compensation from Britain. Activist David Denny celebrated the creation of the Republic, but said he opposes the visit by Prince Charles, noting the royal family for centuries benefited from the slave trade. Quote, our movement would also like the royal family to pay a reparation, Denny said in an interview in Bridgetown. The English initially used white British indentured servants to toil on the plantations of tobacco, cotton, indigo, and sugar, but Barbados in just a few decades would become England's first truly profitable slave society. Barbados received 600,000 enslaved Africans between 1627 and 1833 who were put to work in the sugar plantations, earning fortunes for the English owners. More than 10 million Africans were shackled into the Atlantic slave trade by European nations between the 15th and 19th centuries. And those who survived the often brutal voyage ended up toiling on plantations. Barbados will remain a republic within the Commonwealth, a grouping of 54 countries across Africa, Asia, the Americas, and Europe. And outside the lavish official ceremony, some Barbadians said they were uncertain what the transition to a republic even meant or why it matters. Quote, they should leave Queen Elizabeth B, leave her as the boss. I don't understand what we need to be a republic, said Sean Williams, 45, standing in the shadow of an independence monument. The last time the Queen was removed as head of state was in 1992 when the Indian Ocean Islands of Mauritius proclaimed itself a republic. Wow. So fascinating turn of events there. Let's move on. One second. Where is it here? We're going to jump around here. Iraq's Sadr, evidently his bloc is confirmed as the biggest winner of the October parliamentary vote. Iraq's Shiite Muslim firebrand cleric Muqtada Sadr was on Tuesday, today, confirmed the biggest winner of last month's parliamentary election that had sparked charges of voter fraud from pro-Iranian factions. Sadr's movement won 73 out of the assembly's 329 seats, the election commission said, after a lengthy manual recount of hundreds of ballot boxes. A distant second in the Shiite camp with 17 seats was the Fatah, or Conquest Alliance, the political arm of the pro-Iran Hashed al-Sha'abi former parliamentary force, which is now integrated into Iraq's state security apparatus. Well, Hashed leaders had rejected the preliminary result, which was sharply down from their 48 seats in the outgoing assembly as a scam, and their supporters have held street protests chanting no to fraud. Well, their activists have staged sit-in protests outside Baghdad's ultra-secure green zone district where the government, the assembly, and many foreign embassies are located. Analysts have warned that in a country still recovering from decades of war and chaos, and where most parties have armed wings, political disputes could spark a dangerous escalation. On November 7, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Hademi, the leader of the outgoing government, unhurt when an explosive-packed drone hit his Baghdad residence. The attack was not claimed by any group. The final results must now be sent to the federal court for ratification. The formation of Iraqi governments has involved complex negotiations in the multi-confessional and multi-ethnic country ever since a U.S.-led invasion toppled dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003. Posts and ministries have typically been handed out according to compromises reached by the main blocs in backroom talks rather than to reflect the numbers of seats that parties have won. Sadr is a former leader of the anti-U.S. militia who has often surprised observers with his political maneuvers, has called for a, quote, majority, end quote, government, which analysts say could include Sunni and Kurdish parties. Iraq is an oil-rich country of 40 million people, is still recovering from years of conflict and turmoil. Major fighting has stopped since a military alliance, including the Hashed defeated the Islamic State jihadist groups in 2017, but sporadic violence continues. Military bases housing U.S. troops have been targeted with dozens of missile and drone strikes, which Washington blames on pro-Iran factions. Tensions culminated weeks after the election with the unclaimed drone attack against Hademi. So, more trouble as it is, you know. And this is really interesting in the world's first. Germany has sentenced Iraqi jihadists to life in prison for a Yazidi genocide, A Frankfurt court today handed a life sentence to an Iraqi man who joined the Islamic State group for genocide against the Yazidi minority in the first verdict worldwide to use the label. Taha al-Jumayi, 29, was found guilty of genocide, crimes against humanity resulting in death, war crimes aiding and abetting war crimes, and bodily harm resulting in death after joining the so-called Islamic State group in 2013. Proceedings were suspended as the defendant passed out in court when the verdict was read out. The Yazidis, a Kurdish-speaking group hailing from northern Iraq, have for years been persecuted by Islamic State militants who have killed hundreds of men, raped women, and forcibly recruited children as fighters. In May, the United Nations special investigators reported that they had collected, quote, clear and convincing evidence, end quote, of genocide by Islamic State against the Yazidis. This is the outcome every single Yazidi and old genocide survivors were hoping to see, Natya Navruzov, a lawyer and member of the NGO, the non-governmental organization Yazda, Y-A-Z-D-A, which gathers evidence of crimes committed by Islamic State against the Yazidis, and as they advised Agence France Presse after the verdict. Today is a historical day for humanity, and the Yazidi genocide enters finally the history of international criminal law. We will make sure that more trials such as this take place, she said. Prosecutors say al-Jumayi and his now ex-wife, a German woman named Jennifer Vanish, purchased, quote, end quote, a Yazidi woman and child as household slaves while living in then Islamic State-occupied Mosul, that's the city, in 2015. They later moved to Fallujah, where al-Jumayi is accused of chaining the five-year-old girl to a window outdoors in heat rising to about 122 degrees Fahrenheit as a punishment for wetting her mattress, leading her to die of thirst. In a separate trial, Vanish, who's 30, was sentenced to 10 years in jail in October for, quote, crimes against humanity in the form of enslavement, end quote, and aiding and abetting the girl's killing by failing to offer help. Identified only by her first name, Nora, the child's mother testified in both Munich and Frankfurt, so München und Frankfurt, about the torment visited on her daughter. She also described being raped multiple times by Islamic State jihadists after they invaded her village in the Sinjar Mountains in northwestern Iraq in August of 2014. The mother was represented by a team including London-based human rights lawyer Amal Clooney, who has been at the forefront of a campaign for Islamic State crimes against the Yazidis to be recognized as genocide, along with former Yazidi slave and 2018 Nobel Peace Prize winner Nadia Murad. Although Clooney did not travel to Munich, called Vanish's conviction, quote, a victory for everyone who believes in justice, end quote, adding that she hoped to see, quote, a more concerted global effort to bring Islamic State, another acronym for the Islamic State or ISIS, to justice. Murad has called on the United Nations Security Council to refer cases involving crimes against the Yazidis to the International Criminal Court or to create a specific tribunal for genocide committed against the community. Germany, home to a large Yazidi community, is one of the few countries to have taken legal action over such abuses. German courts have already handed down 5 convictions against women for crimes against humanity related to the Yazidis committed in territories held by Islamic State. Prosecutors in Naumburg on Tuesday charged a German woman named as Leonora M. with aiding and abetting crimes against humanity after she and her Islamic State husband enslaved a Yazidi woman in Syria in 2015. Germany has charged several German and foreign nationals with war crimes and crimes against humanity carried out abroad using the legal principle of universal jurisdiction, which allows offenses to be prosecuted even if they were committed in a foreign country. The trial of Al-Jumayi, quote, sent a clear message, end quote, Lavrusov had advised Agence France-Presse, quote, it doesn't matter where the crimes were committed and it doesn't matter where the perpetrators are. Thanks to the universal jurisdiction, they can't hide and will still be put on trial. Brilliant, 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 to say the least. One second. Well, just so you know, Myanmar's court in Myanmar has delayed the first verdicts in Aung San Suu Kyi's trial. And let me just see how long this perspective is. We just have enough time to listen to this. This is about the story of an awakening, the life and times of Josephine Baker. This comes from France, from France 24. Give them something that doesn't need to ship. Oh, what's this? Oh, no, this was the wrong thing. Okay, bear with me a moment. Where is this? One second. Oh, okay, we're going to get that later. One second.
Give them something that doesn't need.
All right. There it is. Now we'll be able to listen in. Bear with me a moment.
It's time now for Perspective. This Tuesday, following a long campaign by her admirers here in France, Josephine Baker will enter the final resting place of the great and good of French history, the Pantheon in central Paris. The Missouri-born dancer made her mark in the cabarets of Paris in the 1920s. She later went on to work in the French resistance during World War II and also made her mark in the U.S. civil rights movement. My guest today is Elana Navarro, director of a documentary called Josephine Baker, The Story of an Awakening. Thank you so much for speaking to us on FARC 24 today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolute pleasure. So, of course, Josephine Baker went on to become a huge star. We know that. But her beginnings were much more humble. She was born in Missouri, in a segregated America. Can you tell us a little bit more about her early years?
Well, Josephine is a perfect Cinderella story. She actually comes from a very poor background from Missouri, where she was she had only the opportunity to dance for segregated America. And from one day to the next, she becomes, she is invited to Paris as a dancer, and all of a sudden she becomes the muse of all the Parisians. It's really a great story to tell, which is what we try to do. It took like three years to make the documentary that's going on, that you can watch on arte.tv.
And we see some footage behind us, but your documentary includes an extraordinary range of footage from the 20s and 30s, especially. Some footage that's quite difficult to watch. You see Josephine Baker engaging in quite a few what we would consider now racist stereotypes. Is that something that you expect viewers to see, that kind of uncomfortable historical life?
Yes. To look at Josephine is really to be able to confront all of the racism of European and American society. Josephine came to France because she already, well, maybe I should first talk about the dance, I don't know, but yes, let's say, Josephine became famous in France through her scandalous dance. Sometimes she was bare-chested. She's also known for the banana skirt that she wore. She probably was obliged to do these dances. That's what we hear. But she sort of complied with it. She took what was given to her. And at that moment, it was the peak of the French colonial empire. The French weren't ready to look at, the French wanted a black dancer to embody this kind of images. And Josephine took what she had and later on turned it into a political tool. That's the story we tell. It takes a long time. But in fact, yes, she definitely embodies this racist imagery. She turns it around later on to embody also something very modern. That is, as she makes it that the savage dance become a modernity that is desirable. In the 1920s, people are still in their, in the old European traditions, in a very conservative society. People see some sort of a freedom in the way that she dances and want to be like her. And it's a very sort of dérangeant in France, we say.
Unsettling, maybe.
Unsettling to see her nowadays, probably at the time also, but people didn't necessarily have the jargon to talk about it at the time. But yes, that's the story we're telling.
And let's talk for a second about her time as a member of the French Resistance. How did she come to join an underground organization resisting Nazi rule in occupied France?
Josephine was a real star. I mean, she was the most photographed woman of her time. She was, she knew a lot of people. She had Picasso talked about her as the Nefertiti of her time. She was friends with Le Corbusier, who is a very famous French architect. She knew she had a bar in Paris. She knew a lot of people, and she was invited everywhere. So when she realized that France, which was her country of adoption, which had obviously was at a much better place to give her as compared to where she was coming from, which was segregated America, she thought that she could give anything. She could give her life to France. That's how she felt. That's how she talks about it. But it comes from deceptions, many deceptions with her country of origin. In fact, Josephine's real issues were with her own country.
Disappointments.
Yeah. With her own country. And probably the reason why she joined with all this fervor, the French resistance, was in a reaction to the way she was treated in her own country.
And she did eventually go on to become a leading figure in the black civil rights movement in the U.S.,
Some time. Yes, that's much later on. She had a very long life, and she is inspiring also for that because she had the chance to change from becoming a very famous dancer, an icon, to become a hero of the French resistance, and later on she became a civil rights activist. Yes.
And throughout your film, we hear Josephine Baker's voice herself. Which is a very intimate way of getting into
right.
What we imagine was her
exactly.
Mind at the time. Why did you decide to make that artistic call?
Well, we found out that Josephine had written her story many, many times since the beginnings of when she came to Paris in the 1920s. She came to Paris in 1925, and 2 years later, she already had started to talk about her own experiences coming to France, why she came to France. Why France was a place of freedom for her, etc. She started to talk about that, and her initial accounts, her initial stories were very fresh. You could really hear her. She probably didn't speak French that well, so she co-wrote her story with a French writer. But there was something very fresh in the way she realized that people were really watching her as some sort of a strange thing. And she was... realizing that she was being looked at, but she also looked at this French society, which was very racist at the time, even though nothing comparable to the United States, but still. So not just France, but all of Europe, we found this amazing footage of her travels through Europe, and at some point she goes to Netherlands, and she dresses up in a street show as a Dutch peasant with a big hair, and it's a big hat and how do you call them, clogs. And she does her Charleston dance on the street, and people look at her. They've never seen such a thing in her life, and she's a star. And it's almost like she's like when we look at those Dutch peasants, we almost think of them as savages. You don't know who is the savage in this case.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We are running out of time, but it really is an extraordinary documentary. Sort of amazing footage. I really do recommend you see it if you can, especially now as Josephine Baker is about to enter the Pantheon in central Paris. I'm Ilana Navarro, director of Josephine Baker, The Story of an Awakening. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Well, there we are. Fantastic. So that's the end of our day with you today. Let me see, tomorrow... Tomorrow's Wednesday. Bear with me a moment because I'm not quite sure who we have scheduled for tomorrow. I think we may have Dr. Orin M. Levin Waldman. I'm not quite certain on tomorrow's schedule. Well, whatever, we'll post it on the website so you'll be able to learn as I figure out myself who's going to be on tomorrow. So thank you for everyone who attended today. It was very exciting. Thank you to WMU Cooley, Tampa, Florida law professors Brendan Beery and Jeff Swartz, who spoke about the Constitution today and told us what they really think. The guest that called up and had questions, of course, Robert Keston, who's putting on he's having a Zoom meeting to discuss Westchester Human Rights County, and we'll see where that goes. And then, of course, you who've been listening to us during the almost 2 hours. So all the best to you, and enjoy the day, enjoy each other, respect one another. That's really what it's all about. Take care and goodbye.